Today is Wednesday. It's August 10th, 2022. It's 2:37 in the afternoon. And hi, this is John Williams. You are listening now to the Missing Rascals podcast, which we broadcast in part on WGN Radio Saturday nights at 8. Listen for me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the open-minded editor and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel. Beautiful thoughts, beautifully expressed, delivered free to your inbox every Thursday morning.
By the way, you may notice that Eric is always the last of the people to chime in on who's on the podcast this week, which means it's just you and me, Mr. Zorn. Rick Pearson from the Tribune is going to join us in a few minutes to talk about a couple of stories, but it's you and me this week, my friend.
Well, let's see if we can keep the conversation going. We usually can. So
beautifully thoughts. What was the thing that you just did?
Beautiful thoughts, beautifully expressed.
I like that.
It was the tagline. You know, the name Picayune Sentinel came from my grandfather, and that was the name of his newsletter when he was at Indiana University. He would send out this mimeograph newsletter to the math department and other people, and it was called the Picayune Sentinel. And so it was named in his honor, and he was full of wry, self-effacing jokes like beautiful thoughts, beautifully expressed, and things like that. So that was the little motto of his newspaper, and I borrowed it for my own.
I haven't heard you express that in our little podcast here, but I like the sound of that. That's a nice thing to aspire to for all of us, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I fall short some weeks a little bit, but, you know, I do my best. But now you need to ask me why I'm open-minded.
Pardon me. Hey, Eric, why are you so open-minded this week?
I am open-minded about the reasons for the search at Mar-a-Lago, for the search warrant was issued and so on. I'm not going to leap to conclusions yet about what it all means. We haven't seen the warrant. We haven't seen, you know, we don't know what they were looking for. We don't know what they found. And all we know is that it is a fairly arduous process for the federal investigators to get a search warrant to search someone's property like that, that they have to go for a judge and they have to offer convincing proof that not only that a crime was committed and there's evidence there, but there is an urgent need and no other way to get that material. And a judge signed off on this. So we have two branches of government agreeing that this was the thing to do. Now, Trump supporters are all in a lather about, well, this judge once donated to Barack Obama's campaign back in 2008. And
he gave to Republicans also.
He also gave to Jeb Bush, you're right, and trying to just throw shade on him. And even though the FBI is, of course, run by or overseen by a Trump appointee, this is still the deep state out to thwart Trump's hopes of being reelected president. They're convinced that these agents probably planted evidence rather than found it. And there's all kinds of very irresponsible talk. And I haven't heard a lot of Republican leaders trying to douse that talk, to urge the same sort of caution that I'm urging here, which is like, we don't know yet. Most of the time, nearly all the time I can think of, the search warrants are issued. They find things that are important that they had to do. We in Chicago are very accustomed to seeing federal agents walking in and out of the offices and the homes of federal office holders carrying boxes of what looks like evidence and then taking them to trial and winning convictions. So this is not, and we don't get all excited. Alderman Burke but most of the aldermen who are in the dock in Chicago are all Democrats. So you don't hear Democrats carrying on and declaring civil war and abolish the FBI over that. I think there's sort of a bipartisan agreement in Chicago anyway that we like to root out corruption and evildoers among the elected ranks and the bureaucratic ranks.
Yeah, well, Donald Trump is a singular character and all of that. I think most Republicans are against corruption, but Trump is a character that trumps all logic.
And I would never try to persuade anybody who is a dyed-in-the-wool Trump supporter of this, but I think there are a lot of people in this country who by and large might prefer Donald Trump's policy solutions to Democratic policy solutions and who might be inclined to vote for him if that's the choice between him and, say, Joe Biden again or whoever else might run in 2024. There are a lot of people who like those sort of solutions but who are uneasy about his character and who will be, I hope, I think, persuaded by the developments as this goes on They'll be persuaded by the idea that this guy is really unfit to take office again.
Is that about which you are being open-minded? Because
and
I think
we can be better.
I'm
not sounding very open-minded right now, am I? But I am open-minded. I'll wait to see.
I'm not boy, I'll tell you what. I've not been persuaded that any of this is all that consequential, except that it might make Donald Trump more electable, or at least more probable that he would win the nomination.
Really? Because I have the opposite thought.
He was impeached twice. Wouldn't it be ironic, and wouldn't it be less predictable that after two impeachments about his attempts to overthrow the results of the last election, about his role in the insurrection, that because some boxes are in his office that he's not supposed to have, that this would somehow be his undoing?
It's a felony, and it was a law that Trump signed in 2018. And if you remember, Trump was extremely agitated back in 2016 about Hillary Clinton supposedly mishandling classified
information. Sure, I'm well aware of that.
In her emails.
I'm well aware of that. But I mean, so you said open-minded, but not optimistic. In the name of justice, what's your best case scenario here?
My best case scenario?
Sure.
Trump gets sanctioned. I don't think you could lock him up for this. I don't think he would lock him up for this. But if he definitely squirreled away confidential documents, classified documents, and didn't return them as he was supposed to, that's a crime.
You know, here's one of the things that kind of troubles me about this. I don't think he's sufficiently curious or interested in classified documents. When he was president, he didn't want to read classified documents. The idea that he's harboring some secret documents there that are of great import to the United States strikes me as unlikely. I think he's more got framed pictures of him and Kim Jong-un in there, and he wants to keep them because they're pretty cool. And by the way, some of the reporting has suggested that something like that is among the artifacts in those boxes. And I appreciate what you're saying about the fact that the threshold for this to happen is pretty high, especially when the past president is this president. By God, you guys better have the goods. Even if it is completely compromising, do you think that would significantly keep him from winning the Republican nomination were he to run?
My thought is that there are enough Republicans who really want to win the White House in 2024 and who, at least in their hearts, realize that Trump was a loser in 2020 and that nothing he's done since then makes him more likely to win, that they will look for another candidate. That's my thought.
I don't even know you anymore, Eric Zorn. Who are you?
I don't know. Let's ask Rick Pearson what he thinks.
Rick Pearson now joins us from the Chicago Tribune, not to opine on this, although he could, but we're going to ask him about the state race as well. How are you, Mr. Pearson?
I'm good. And I'm just happy to listen. I'm fine with that.
Well, I'm trying to beat Eric Zorn up on here because he's normally the great pessimist, and now he's naively holding out that the results of this not raid, but executed search warrant at Mar-a-Lago. If somebody reminded me that you should be careful about the verbs you use on this. Raid makes it sound inappropriate, like he's the victim here, when in fact it was a search warrant that they were executing. So it's okay. But I'm a little surprised that after all we've been through, Eric thinks that this is going to be the one that sticks. Maybe I'm a little dissuaded by all of that because of the pictures from the upcoming Maggie Haberman book, the torn up pieces of paper in the toilet. I don't believe that those are what they say they are, or that those are even important things. But right when that got released, then the FBI kicks in the door and they start going through Trump's place. Why are other Republicans and conservative media members encouraging the president to announce his candidacy right now? They think that he can use the momentum. Imagine that, the momentum of this moment.
I just don't think that's the case. I don't think that he will be able to use the momentum from this. I'm not sure that this is going to be the thing that does him in, but I think it is another chink in the armor, so to speak. This is another problem that he's going to be facing, and that when you start presenting, you know, some of his statements about Hillary Clinton and her laptop and classified material, and then when you present the whole thing where he took the Fifth Amendment today
on a separate
and all
case,
the state
yeah.
all on a separate case, but he over and over again before this has talked about how the Fifth Amendment is what is claimed by mobsters and criminals. They got nothing to hide. Why would you? Why would you claim take the Fifth Amendment? All kinds of hypocrisy. again, you know, obviously, no one thing has done him in yet. And from the time that he called Mexicans rapists to the time he declared that John McCain wasn't a war hero, all these mistakes that people thought, well, that's the end of Donald Trump. That never has happened. And I don't think this particular search warrant is necessarily the end of Donald Trump by any means. But I think that it is one more factor that Republican primary voters are going to weigh when they are faced with potentially the option of Trump or a Ron DeSantis in the primaries. And they're going to say, do we really want this guy who is so compromised, who is so focused on the past, who has already had 4 years, who is so divisive? Obviously, there's a chunk of the voting public that really wants him back. But I still think that there is a persuadable group of people in the middle who, as I said, are fine with most of Trump's policies, who really don't like his attitude and his deportment, so to speak, and that they are looking for another plausible option. And if you give them one, they may take it. And this is just going to be one more straw on the camel's back.
Yeah, I think there's a totality of issues going on, legal issues. This on itself, I don't think it's like the deal breaker that keeps him from running for president. But when you look at this variety of other legal issues that he's entangled with, plus whatever may arise from the Justice Department as it starts to coordinate more closely with the January 6th committee, I mean, there's a lot of stay tuned here. An issue over the National Archives and basically, which is a felony, and it's a felony under a law Trump signed, which is part of the irony here. I think there's going to be a lot more out there. I mean, you've got House Ways and Means Committee won the right to look at his tax returns. You've got the issues going on in state court in Georgia over trying to influence the outcome of the election after the fact there. When you start having all of those kinds of legal issues, I think then there becomes maybe a totality there.
But all of those are part and parcel of the man who got 70 million votes in the last election. And I know that a lot of the things you were referring to were post-election, but it's the same guy. I honestly think that he plays a little bit of the victim card. This falls into the narrative that that the, you know, deep state is out to get me, with no evidence to support it, that this is Joe Biden weaponizing the Justice Department or the FBI. And of course, none of that makes a shred of sense. The FBI is the most Republican of federal agencies, and it's headed by a guy that he appointed. So, you know,
But to show you still, and you're right, this hold that he does have over Republicans and not just Republican base voter, but over the Republican infrastructure. The Illinois Republican Party put out a statement with its chairman, Don Tracy. The Illinois Republican Party, which is mainly a party in name only because they don't have any cash or ability to do much, but they put out a statement demanding that Merrick Garland explain what this is all about.
Well, Hugh Hewitt had a column in the Washington Post today, not saying that, but he was saying that Trump, he and his lawyers have copies of this search warrant, which is not public, and he called on Trump to release it and show the public what it was about, what they were looking for. Trump, as far as we're speaking now, has not done that.
Yeah.
And Merrick Garland, I don't know that they really want Merrick Garland explaining what they have on Trump right now. I don't know that they want to have these hearings. McCarthy said he was going to, when the Republicans take back the House, which they probably will, that McCarthy was saying that they're going to hold hearings and look into everything, and they were telling Merrick Garland to save all his records, that he's going to be called in front of Congress. I don't think they really want those hearings, because when you talk about what evidence they presented to this judge, the Republicans are going to want to try to put that kind of stuff behind them. And they don't really want Merrick Garland out there explaining what the search warrant was about and what they had and what they told the judge.
Well, the president has a receipt. Donald Trump has a ticker that says, here's what we took.
And he can release it if he wants. He and his lawyers can release it. They haven't. And you got to ask yourself why. Now, as I said, you know, Occam's razor, the principle that the simplest explanation is the most plausible one, tells you that they have some serious dirt on him. They can't, you're not going to get a magistrate judge to allow a search warrant of a former president's house unless you make a pretty compelling case, unless you've got some pretty good evidence there.
Yeah. That magistrate judge was appointed by other judges. You said that he had given money to Obama's campaign. I think it was $1,000 and $500 to Bush's campaign. So he seems to be a, you know, publicly anyway, relatively nonpartisan character who, according to at least the state's attorney in the county there in Florida, said he is known to be very meticulous, but doesn't seem to have a political axe to grind. One of the other things that I think distinguishes Donald Trump from the rest of the potential field, I think, Eric, it was you that mentioned DeSantis in Florida, is that none of them seem to have the charisma that Donald Trump does. So even if it's the same playbook, I don't think they sell it or play it as well. I don't know if you saw what Ken Griffin said in his interview with Chris Jones in the Chicago Tribune about what life is like in Florida for him. But
I did see that. Anyway, it sounds like heaven down there.
Oh, my God.
Wakes up every day and talks to his friends, and they don't worry about crime.
I just want to quote from it. This is, and again, this is the hedge fund billionaire who has put a lot of money into the gubernatorial campaign on the Republican side. He picked the wrong horse in Illinois. He says he's not going to play this game anymore in our state, but he does seem to be interested in Florida politics and national politics. And in the Tribune with the editorial page editor, Chris Jones, had a long full-page interview here. And these are quotes from Ken Griffin. "Woke up in Miami this morning, will fall asleep in Miami tonight. And I have a variety of my friends from Chicago there. I will say, though, coming back to Chicago today, it's really great to hear how Lala was a big success in the city last week. It was wonderful to see some people on the street. I hope that momentum stays." But then later in the interview, he said that if Ron DeSantis decides to run for president, I'm pretty confident I'm going to be a big supporter of his. "Let me give you the quote," he says to Chris Jones. "When you live in Florida, the optimism about the future of the city, the state, and the country is palpable. It is so refreshing to experience that. I have no words for it. The other great thing is you never sit down and talk about crime. It's just so refreshing to be out with friends, talking about the businesses that you're creating, talking about where your kids are hoping to go to college or the camps they're in or the classes they're taking or about team sports. You're engaged in the present and then in the future. This is how I felt when Chicago was so positive, when Rahm Emanuel was mayor, or when Richie Daley was the mayor of this city."
It sounds to me like he lives in something of a bubble down in Florida. And you could probably say the same thing about a lot of wealthy communities in Illinois, where people wake up every morning and they talk about, what are you saying, kids camps, and they don't talk about crime because crime doesn't affect them. I don't know what the comparative crime rates are for the state of Florida versus the state of Illinois. I imagine they're somewhat similar. This just seems like he's just throwing shade back at Illinois.
It does that, and I also get very defensive about that sort of stuff. Are you going to quit then? Are you just going to pack up and leave? I don't like that attitude. But I also, he's right about that. Chicagoans talk about crime, even in the nice town parts of the city, even in the nice suburbs. People in Chicagoland talk about the crime of Chicago all the time. If they don't do that in Florida, that's a big difference.
Well, Rick, have you looked at do you know what the various crime rates are?
I believe Miami does have a bigger and higher crime rate than Chicago.
A lot of cities do. Rockford does.
You know, his principal explanation for leaving was because of the crime and recruiting people to work at Citadel and those kinds of things. But, you know, John, to your point about, I mean, I remember talking about crime in Chicago growing up in the suburbs in the 60s. I mean, it's just part of the fabric of the city. I mean, not that we're happy about it, but, you know, it's part of the civic conversation and has been. Certainly elevated by these more sporadic and more violent gun crimes that are going on. To me, he sounds like he's talking about La La Land.
Rick, we asked you to join us today because you follow state politics as well as anybody in any state, and we had questions about the gubernatorial race between Darren Bailey and J.B. Pritzker. I don't know that this is the best place to start, but it does seem to be most top of mind today. It's page 2 of the Chicago Tribune. Darren Bailey's Holocaust comments, I guess, are a thing now. To be clear, Darren Bailey is the downstate senator and Republican nominee for governor, and his poor choice of words before he was a candidate, like 5 years ago, could easily have been dismissed by now. He could have said the comparison was a poor one. He could have thrown in a few more sentences of contrition. This thing would have gone away. But J.B. Pritzker is now using that old Facebook audio in an ad, so now Bailey is defending it. He said he's reached out to the Jewish community and that they agree that he got it right. That both are terrible things, but the scourge of abortion is in fact worse than the Nazi extermination program. The comment that started this absurd debate was Bailey saying, and I think it was 2017, right?
Right.
The attempted extermination of Jews in World War II does not even compare on a shade of the life that has been lost with abortion.
I believe that abortion is one of the greatest atrocities of our day, and I believe it's one of the greatest atrocities probably forever. The attempted extermination of the Jews of World War II, it doesn't even compare on a shadow of the life that has been lost and with abortion since its legalization.
Now, Bailey said at the Kendall County Fair in Yorkville on Monday, we met with the Jewish rabbis and they said, no, you're actually right. Have you rounded up the rabbis that told him that? Who is the Jewish community?
Who is it? I'm still waiting for the answer and didn't quite frankly expect to get one.
Weren't you at an event with him this week? Weren't you in front of him recently?
I was at an event with him on Sunday. He would not answer any of my questions.
Was he taking questions generally? Was it a scribe or something?
I was the only media there.
Well, then he could have called on you.
I was asking him questions as he was walking out of the event.
And?
No answer. No response. He basically said that I've been telling a lot of untruths.
Do you know what he was talking about there?
I asked him. No response.
Mayor Richard Irvin, who was a candidate, sure tried to distance himself from the media and didn't take many questions.
Well, actually, I mean, not to defend Irvin, but when he did have a full-blown press conference. Now, granted, he ended up not answering really very many questions, but he took questions. Bailey, not taking a lot of questions. I was surprised to see this interview he did with a Plano radio station.
WSPY Plano, where I got my start.
Well, I wondered about that.
Sandwich Plano, Yorkville.
Yes, I was just going to say SPY. But I figure he assumed that he doesn't trust the Chicago media at all, and neither does his campaign. And there has been kind of NPR actually had a story on this in the last few days about conservative Republican candidates for governor just trying to bypass legacy media.
But in a state where the population is centered in one big city, I don't know how do you do that?
You know, the other day when he was endorsed by the FOP, and they billed it as a press conference, and he took no questions. And to me, my job isn't to be the public relations arm of a political candidate. And so if you're not going to answer my questions, don't expect to get a hell of a lot of publicity about whatever event you're doing.
Well, you don't think the FOP endorsement is significant or important?
No, not really. I don't. They weren't going to endorse Pritzker.
Yeah, when was the last time they endorsed a Democrat for governor or mayor? Or, well, mayor is nonpartisan, but when was the last time they endorsed a Democrat?
I believe the state FOP might have endorsed Pritzker. I'm not sure. That might have been over Rauner's anti-union positioning.
Rick, how important are union endorsements in general?
To me, they start to fall under the expectation category. It's like you point out, when a union endorses a Republican, is kind of a news kind of thing. But truly, you know, and obviously 4 years ago with Rauner and his anti-unionism, that served as a rallying call for organized labor of all stripes, including folks like the operating engineers who are probably about 50-50 Republican and Democrat in their membership. But I still, unions are a very kind of the vestige of the what used to be the patronage army. and there isn't those patronage armies that exist anymore, and the unions are the actual bodies to get out and get people to show up at the doors and vote.
Yeah, we double-checked. So the Illinois Fraternal Order of Police did endorse Pritzker.
That was newsworthy at that time, because that was not, that's not the way they typically go. But again, I think that was largely motivated by Rauner's efforts to try to change public employee pensions.
I wonder if the endorsement does have a little more heft to it now, since crime is such a, being the law and order candidate does seem to be top of mind for a lot of people. What are the issues that Darren Bailey is running on?
You just said it. Basically, it's crime. And he keeps trying to drive that. Although I should point out that in the primary polling, particularly in the suburbs, which of course are the kind of the key swing area and the deciding area, that crime did not rank high as a concern of voters. More of the nature of the economics of inflation, of gas prices, of pocketbook issues, crime did not rank very high. You know, even Irvin tried to make that the centerpiece of the primary campaign for him.
Yeah, that's true.
And was largely disregarded overwhelmingly in favor of a regional Southern Illinois candidate like Darren Bailey.
First of all, where is crime a real issue? And I think that's those are high crime areas, which also tend to be Democratic areas, is certainly one thing. And the other thing, of course, is what role do governors really have in crime? I realize there's the Safety Act that's controversial about limiting cash bail and things like that. But that in general, I always feel like Irvin was running for sheriff of Illinois, that his whole approach to the campaign. And I'm feeling that from Bailey, too, which is like, well, what exactly do you think a governor is supposed to do about this? You've got county sheriffs, you've got county prosecutors, you have mayors, all of whom are much closer to the front lines of the crime problem than the governor. I don't understand that line. I mean, I guess it must play well, but really, do governors have much of a role in crime?
I mean, again, since he doesn't take questions, one of the questions he has said he wants to repeal the Safety Act. And the question is, okay, how are you going to get that done?
What's the Safety Act?
Well, that is the comprehensive criminal justice reform package that was approved, was one of the pillars of the Black Legislative Caucus. It includes, moving forward in January, that's where it's the cashless bail for nonviolent offenders. That's things like requiring all police officers to wear recording working body cameras, more training for police. I mean, it's a very large piece of legislation.
And that legislation passed. Is it in play now, or does that not happen yet?
Parts of it are in play. Parts of it also take effect, like the cashless bail take effect in January.
And if even he doesn't have sway over that, I mean, could a governor somehow rescind that or change that or beef that up? So I take your point, Eric, that you do wonder, while a candidate can identify the frustrations and problems that people feel, he's not in a position to do that much about it. What can the governor do to reduce crime in Chicago?
Right. And of course, there's no necessarily any evidence that repealing the Safety Act would change crime rates. I mean, that you're sort of operating on this assumption that even the passage of this act increased certain crimes in the city and the suburbs. I don't think that that's necessarily true. So that it's hard even to make the case that if you were to be able to do this, which as Rick points out, there doesn't seem to be a path unless there's some sort of dramatic turnaround in the General Assembly, which I don't think anybody is predicting. A Republican governor is going to end up being as feckless as Bruce Rauner was, complaining and whining and vetoing legislation, but unable really to enact much.
In that Chris Jones article where he interviewed Ken Griffin, he asked about DeSantis because he was imagining a J.B. Pritzker DeSantis presidential election.
I believe Ken Griffin is one of the top DeSantis donors. And that occurred before he even left Chicago. For him to say all these great things about DeSantis isn't surprising, given that's where he's put his money on. As far as a DeSantis-Pritzker contest, I don't think we'll see it.
Do you think either of those candidates, who's more likely to actually be on the top of a ticket? I guess DeSantis, right?
Yeah, I mean, just because we know that Republicans have a, you know, open call here.
Oh, that's right. Excuse me, Joe Biden, if you're listening to the Mincing Rascals, I didn't mean to suggest that you won't be running again and get the endorsement of your party. Is Joe Biden going to be on the top of the ticket?
At this point, I have to say, I think he will be. And obviously, there is a long way to go to 2024. I'm putting together a paper on something about, you know, how if you just think a couple of months ago and this big red wave was just going to be a tsunami in the midterms. And, you know, now you're starting to see these various actions like the court overturning Roe, the impending passage of the Inflation Reduction Act and all of that that contains. And you're starting to see actually some Democratic victories on that side of the aisle where Democrats themselves in Washington, including the president's, they all looked feckless. They didn't look like they, you know, we've got this. What do we do with it? Now, granted, you know, certainly it's not the super majorities that you have here in Illinois, but you are starting to see some movement that goes in favor of the Democrats, even to the point of, you know, this historic reduction in gas prices. And to me, you know, gas prices are a big barometer on voter attitudes.
Yeah, one
right. And of course, gas prices are things that you see as you drive down the street. Grocery prices are things that you see when you look at the tape at the end of your shopping expedition. But gas prices really confront people. Rick's exactly right that the gas prices have dropped precipitously, and they may drop further into the fall. So that may be a little bit less of an issue for voters in November. The other thing is that you know, you were listing those accomplishments or those successes under Biden, which would include the killing of the mastermind of 9/11, al-Zawahiri, and again the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, and also what happened in Kansas. The referendum there suggests that there's some energized voters out there who are on the left. So it may not be the bloodbath that people are expecting, and that may be attributable to Biden in the minds of a lot of voters. So you might end up with someone, you know, with Biden, assuming that he doesn't suffer any more in sort of physical declines. I think cognitively he seems like he's still on the ball. He's looking kind of old and frail as he walks around. And it might be that at some point he will bow out. I now agree with Rick. I think if you'd asked me a month ago, I think I probably said at the time, I don't think Biden's going to do it. This recent record has made me think that perhaps Biden is going to try to stick around if he's up for it. But in any case, I think he needs to make that call pretty soon, that the candidates for 2024 are going to announce in early 2023. And that's when Obama announced for president. That tends to be those first few months of 2023 is when the runway is long to take off in a presidential campaign, especially when you're not an incumbent. And
yeah, right.
So if you want to give someone like a Gavin Newsom or a J.B. Pritzker or Kamala Harris, for that matter, enough time to get the money, get the support, round up things, meet the voters, you're going to need to do that pretty early in 2023.
He would be the oldest president. I don't understand why anybody wants to be president once, but if you're him, do you want to be president more? You've done everything. You've had every office. You've suffered every tragedy. And in fact, the only reason he won it was because he wasn't Donald Trump. I think in the next election, people wouldn't be voting so much for his accomplishments, Eric, like we got the number two guy in Al-Qaeda or gas prices are going down, as much as they would say we are upset with Roe v. Wade. We are upset with conservative inaction on gun legislation. People might be more inclined to vote Democrat because they're mad at the Republicans rather than, boy, isn't Joe Biden doing a great job and we want four more years of that.
I know Rick only likes to talk about one election at a time, but what are the names that you hear floated besides Pritzker, Gavin Newsom, Kamala Harris? Who are the Democrats people are talking about?
It's a very limited field at this point, but that's not to say you know, if Biden says, I'm not running again, there'll be 5,000 Democrats running.
Like, yeah. Who? Is there somebody else out there that you've seen?
John, everybody who's in elective office thinks they could be president.
Tim Ryan, the Democrat running for Senate in Ohio, did really poorly last time. He made an effort to run for president last time, did pretty poorly. But if he manages to beat J.D. Vance, I think he becomes in that top tier, because he's the kind of moderate
Midwest
grassrootsy Midwest Democrat who might be able to win over those vote. Those, I mean, you have people who are literally they were Bush, Obama, Trump voters. And there are some people who were, so you've got people who are in the middle there. And I think that those are the kind of people who would be attracted by someone like a Tim Ryan, just to throw another name out there. I'm sure there are a whole passel of them. And
Willie
Rick's
Wilson.
Right. You're going to have one of
them. According to Rick Wilson, Pearson, Willie Wilson then would be a candidate for president.
Well, he was.
He did.
He did run.
As a Republican, right?
Yes.
In Iowa, yeah.
Are Willie Wilson?
Yes, he ran. And it was actually more South Carolina than it was Iowa. And then he dropped out after South Carolina.
In 2019, there were 14 candidates on the ballot for mayor of Chicago. Right now, there are 9 declared candidates. Obviously, some of them are going to drop off, and there are people like Pat Quinn who might jump in. How many candidates do you think are going to be on the 2023 ballot? Any rough guesses?
I would expect about the same. I mean, I don't think we're. I mean, obviously, you know, Sophia King being the latest to jump in, but I don't think we're done yet. And I would expect about the same or perhaps even more. I'm not saying I know people that are going to be jumping in. But I have to believe when you look at this field that there aren't people that in their own mind see an opportunity.
Speaking of this city, I wanted to just bring up something that we've been talking about here a little bit, and that was NASCAR coming to Chicago. A week ago, the Illinois Policy Institute's Austin Berg was on our panel, and he said about the deal that the city cut with NASCAR, we don't even know what's in the contract. Is it a good idea to give up our roads for a couple of weeks so NASCAR drivers can zoom around Buckingham Fountain? And at first blush, I said yes. Most everybody else on the panel said no, in no small part, because it would happen on the 4th of July weekend. That's a crowded, problematic time in Chicago, usually. Well, now we do have the contract, and the details include these. NASCAR will be given 3 weeks to set up for the race, and then 10 days to break everything down. Add those numbers together. For some of the most famous and prettiest streets in Chicago, NASCAR will pay the city $2 per ticket sold, and they expect to sell maybe 100,000. In the first year, we get 15% of the net on food and beverages. NASCAR will pay a permit fee of $500,000. And they make a $50,000 security deposit in case they break anything. I think there's also maybe $2 million to go to public schools and $2 million to go to the park. But the numbers don't add up that much. NASCAR keeps 100% of the broadcast rights, 100% of sponsorship sales. Whoever cut this deal for the city, I hope they don't do my next contract. Because I'm not the first one to note that maybe they left some money on the table, the city did.
That's what I noticed about this, too. And it just, I mean, one, you know, initially we had heard it was only going to be 2 weeks of shutdown. Now we're talking a month. We're talking a month in primetime summer tourism Chicago. And the rate of return is, I don't know if we got the same people who negotiated the parking meter deal. The idea of showcasing Chicago as a world-class city has always been kind of the mantra of the mayor in this whole deal. And the fact is, one, we already are. So if you're going to basically encumber the city's residents, there better be a damn good rate of return for it.
You mentioned the parking meter deal, and of course, the similarity between that deal and this is that it was sort of all done in secret. It was all negotiated and then sort of presented
Right.
And here's what's going to happen. And I don't believe that the city council even voted on the NASCAR thing. They just said this is happening.
Yeah, because it's being done through the park district. That's why.
So, this gets to this lack of transparency and it's the autocratic tendencies that Lightfoot shows, which is not, of course, unique to Chicago mayors, but that, I mean, obviously this is going to happen after the election next year, so it's not going to play a role in it. But I certainly hear, John, a lot of people talking informally about this and saying the same thing that both you guys have already said, which is this doesn't sound like a very good deal. And it sounds like it's going to be a real pain in the ass around July 4th.
I think this is what might be in it for the mayor. And it's not the first time we've suggested it on this podcast. She can say, yeah, but I got that. I got this. We got a casino. We're going to maybe save the stadium for the Bears. And what do you know? NASCAR's coming to town.
I don't know how popular the casino is. I haven't seen any polling on that. And she's not going to save the Bears. I just don't believe that that's going to happen. I don't think that her plans to build the Bears may back out of Arlington Heights. They may not get the money. But I don't think it's going to be because of the mayor's, $2 billion proposal to revamp the museum campus. I don't think that's going to play into it. I'm not sure how much these are advertising slogans or how much these are going to be ads that are going to be run by her opponents.
And I'm not sure how popular NASCAR is in the Chicago market. You know, going back to that world-class city thing, I'd be a lot more amenable if they were running F1 races down. You know, kind of like some of those international races they do. That would be a world class.
Do you get up on Sunday mornings to watch the Formula One series?
I mean, I do.
It's a staple for us. But I think in America, it's NASCAR.
I totally understand it, but I'm just not sure when you talk about sports among Chicagoans if NASCAR is that big of a part of the conversation.
This is interesting, John, that you're a Grand Prix racing fan. My daughter is also one, and she was converted by that Netflix series.
Absolutely. That's what got us into it.
So,
Drive to Survive.
But what I don't understand, though, is how do you do a NASCAR race? It looks like they're going to be a street race, kind of. It's not going to be at that real high speeds. It's going to be a different kind of race. It's going to be almost Grand Prix-like.
Hard to go real fast.
And is this going to be an exhibition for the NASCAR series? I don't really know how that all works.
But
is it going to matter to anybody?
It doesn't have to. I think you guys are thinking about the wrong thing. We're going to be on TV. I know we're not Peoria, really. We are already a world-class. But when's the... Think about that. Tell me how many times Chicago gets a national audience in a favorable light in front of a new audience, right? You can imagine what the visuals will be like to people who I think have made up their mind that Chicago is too dangerous to come here. Who knows what the residual value of that is?
You might have a future as a mayoral spokesman, John. That was pretty good.
It's a load of crap, maybe, but it was my crap, and I'm going to stay with it.
Even in a bad year, how many times are the Bears in a nationally televised game?
I don't know. What's your answer to that?
Probably at least 3 times because of the market size.
In the winter.
They're still running the pictures. The city still looks beautiful. Again, it seems like a culture clash.
Well, that's what Laura Washington said. This isn't a NASCAR town. What business is it of ours to repair their image and try and make it look more ethnic or more diverse or something? But I don't see why we're against that either. I mean, maybe it's not a perfect match, but you guys sound like you sound like White Sox fans. We don't want you guys in our stadium. You know, White Sox fans would love to see the city embrace them the way they do the Cubs, but White Sox fans don't want Cubs fans to come in. They're like, well, no, you're not one of us. We don't want you. What the hell's that?
I can speak from personal experience when the Ricketts family started the Marquee Network, and I converted from Cubs to White Sox.
You've been making a campaign out of that.
I got a load of email from White Sox fans saying, no thanks, we don't want you. Bandwagon jumper north side. Yeah, no, I'm kidding. They didn't want me. But neither team
seems to be in a position to grow their base right now.
Oh, then the White Sox just lost Anderson
for 6 weeks.
6 weeks. They're done. They're done for the season, I'm afraid. And the Cubs could still come back, right, Rick?
No. No. The chances of that are like the Bears playing in Soldier Field under a dome.
So my producer Pete just handed this to me. J.B. Pritzker and Darren Bailey were at the Butter Cow unveiling. Is this at the State Fair? Where do they do this?
Yes, this is the State Fair.
And he said, why can't the Republicans just stand up and say what Darren Bailey said was wrong? Why can't Darren Bailey just apologize? He's twisted himself into knots, first trying to explain what he said, and then going back and saying he meant what he said. This is a guy who does not understand what it takes to be a leader in Illinois. What Senator Bailey said is offensive. It's offensive to me as someone who is Jewish. It's offensive to me as someone who built a Holocaust museum with Holocaust survivors. He owes an apology to them. He owes an apology to those survivors and their families.
And I will say, John, the issue of apology is absolutely correct on, is that when this 2017 thing first surfaced, now in the midst of this campaign, Bailey issued a statement to try to clarify what he meant, but he did not apologize for it. He didn't apologize for using the words. And now, and then in other subsequent conversations, he's claimed he was taken out of context. Well, you can't take that out of context.
Which is it? Well, I mean, the truth is that what Darren Bailey said is consistent with a strong anti-abortion position, which is, if you consider an abortion at 6 weeks to be equivalent to pulling someone off the street and killing them, sending them off to a death camp. But when you are arguing that abortion is murder, like that, and I don't want to get into the whole abortion debate, but that's their position. So that when you look at the actual body count, he's right. There are more abortions in this country in the last 20, 30 years than there were people who were killed in the Holocaust. I don't think myself. I think that comparison is obtuse and fairly vile.
Among other things, it's who cares? What are we doing here?
I don't know that it's anti-Semitic, because it doesn't devalue Jewish lives. What it does is it elevates fetal life to the equivalent of people who are killed like that. And as I say, I think that just is, you just don't compare things to the Holocaust, period. You don't even need to go there. You can give the numbers of abortions that have happened, and you can argue that it's all murder. But I think as soon as you start invoking the Holocaust, you've just stepped on a landmine politically. And Pritzker is correct to say that this is not evidence of smart leadership, savvy leadership. And it reminded me a little bit of what Bailey's mistake on July 4th, when there was the shooting in Highland Park. And a couple hours later, he says, oh, let's carry on and celebrate. that the guy doesn't have those political instincts that you need to be a leader, to say the things that bring people together rather than push them apart.
Producer Pete has also just handed me this. Major League Baseball will not return to the Field of Dreams site in 2023, according to their owner, Hall of Famer Frank Thomas, part of the new ownership group that owns and operates the Field of Dreams. And he said, yes, the construction plans at the movie site will prevent a return next year for MLB. It's a lot going on, he said. They don't want to come back if the stadium's not prepared. So Chicago teams will have played in the two games there, the Sox last year and the Cubs this year, when they take on the Reds.
Oh, last year's was a terrific game, if you remember. It was
Tim Anderson with a dramatic hit at the end. But
so what, are they building a bigger stadium? Because part of the charm of that whole thing was how small the crowd was and how kind of quaint the setting was. If you build a huge stadium, all you got is just a ballpark with corn in the outfield. I think that's a mistake. But
they're going to have a youth baseball and softball complex that they hope to begin construction on later this summer. It'll be one of those places where the kids go for the massive tournaments. It'll be one of those things. They're going to build it out that way. So rather than accommodate one Major League Baseball game, they're going to accommodate thousands of kids from Oklahoma who want to come here and take on the kids from Ohio. One of those things. You can make a lot of money on that. That is a very good, having watched my son play a little travel baseball, just a little bit, but a lot of his friends and families were wrapped up in that, and wow, can you make money on that?
That movie is 33 years old now. I just wonder what kind of hold it has on young players anymore. Like, oh, we get to go to where they filmed that movie back when my parents were teenagers. I don't understand why they're doing that, but the game itself was very cool.
Yeah, it was.
I hope it does return there.
It needs to be part of the Marvel universe, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I get that. By the way, the last thing I'll just throw at you guys was the video of the Texas team that was playing in the Little League World Series against an Oklahoma team, and the pitcher from Texas hit the Oklahoma kid in the head. I don't know if you saw it, but you could hear it, and it looked like it was going to hit that poor kid right in the eye. Mostly hit his helmet, and so the Oklahoma kid then goes to first base, but that episode so unnerved the pitcher for Texas, this big kid standing on the mound, that he's losing his composure. He's starting to cry. You see that sometimes in Little League games. These are still boys. And so the kid on first base, who was the hitter that got beaned, takes off his helmet and walks over to the mound and gives the kid a hug. And then he's part of the team meeting there, and they're all consoling the kid. He says, hey, you're doing great. I'm okay. The kid said that. So often us adults don't know how to behave in these sorts of circumstances, but wasn't that nice? We told that story on the radio today, and that kid's grandmother texted in and said, that's my grandson, and my son's the coach of the team. Yeah, they're from St. Charles. So we interviewed him, and he turned out to be just as gracious a guy as you can be, this Texas coach who said what great sportsmanship the kid from Oklahoma displayed. He was in a good mood because they won the game, so they're going on to the World Series. But it's a really nice story. Eric, you saw that video too, right?
I did, and I was as moved by it as you were. I thought it was just a terrific example of what youth sports can be about and should be about. Loved it.
And on that, hey, guys, a smaller group today, but really nice to have you join us, Rick. I hope you can join us once and again.
Thank you much. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, great talking to you, Rick.
So that's Rick Pearson and Eric Zorn. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. We'll drop another podcast on you next week. It's kind of funny because I haven't seen Rick in a long time, and now I've seen him twice in 2 days, once here on our Zoomcast, and then yesterday. Wasn't it yesterday we bumped into each other?
It was the day before yesterday.
2 days ago at the Billy Goat.
But I liked Johnny texted me Bertrand's line about how you remarked you saw me at the Billy Goat.
Yeah.
And Bertrand said, that's like seeing a ball player at the ballpark.
Well, I walked in there and I thought, you know, I'll bet there's none of these legendary journalists here, like they always say. There's one guy at the bar, Rick Pearson. I go, yes, it's still happening. And then you gave me gruff about the WGN Golden Lager because they had some of our beer. And I said, hey, I want some of that good WGN beer. And you did not sing its praises, Rick. I was greatly disappointed.
It was too hoppy. I didn't like it.
It's not hoppy. It's a golden.
I'll also admit I'm not a beer drinker.
Well, now you need to say that.
Well, but part of that was performance art for the help.
It really was. You were enjoying that,
John. If you want to have them send a case of it over here, I will be the judge of this. I'll be the final arbiter of whether it's too hoppy or not.
I wasn't going to convince the bartender there that it was a great beer, but I know many people who went to a lot of liquor stores when that beer dropped, and they could not get it because it was running out.
Really?
It's the Coors of 2022.
It really was. It had its moment. All right, boys. Thanks, Rick.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
Good to see you.
Bye-bye.
See
you, Rick.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.